Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 22nd of May, these are our main stories. A passenger has died and dozens have been injured after a plane flying from London encountered severe turbulence. Ukraine has expressed gratitude to the EU for sending its profits generated from seized Russian central bank assets, but says the assets themselves should be used for Kiev's war effort. Lawyers for Donald Trump have rested their case in the fraud trial of the former US president. Also in this podcast, 16 of the world's largest AI firms have agreed on new safety guidelines at the Global Artificial Intelligence Summit. And
we found that around periods of artillery fire or intense shelling, our birds deviated from their normal routes, causing them to change direction and fly further than they normally would on migration.
How the war in Ukraine is affecting migrating birds. One man has died and 30 people have been injured after a Singapore-bound flight from London was rocked by severe turbulence while cabin crew were serving breakfast. The Singapore Airlines plane made an emergency landing in Bangkok, and some of those on board have been describing it as the worst day of their lives. Andrew Davis was there.
Literally, I think, as soon as I put it on, just a sudden thud and the aircraft dropping. The thing that really stays in my mind is just seeing possessions and cushions and plates just flying up. But when it stopped, everybody was very shaken. I mean, it sounds crazy to say it now, but I did go through my mind, is this fatal? Is this going down? I mean, remembering the plane now, the huge dents in the roof where people had obviously hit with their head. There was a water bottle stuck in a gap in the ceiling. And there were bits of seat back lying on the floor. Gosh, it's really sounding quite bad now. I don't think I realised how awful it was. And unfortunately, the gentleman did lose his life, which was sitting literally on the road behind me.
Jerry and his family were walking around as the plane plunged.
It was a long way and so sudden, there was no warning at all. And I ended up hitting my head on the ceiling, my wife did. Some poor people who were walking around ended up doing somersaults. Ended up in the hospital and it was fairly chaotic. Lots of injured people. They say 30, seem more than 30 to me.
Our correspondent Theo Leggett told me more.
So what happened with this aircraft was it took off at about 10:30 p.m. local time from London's Heathrow Airport on Monday evening. It flew for about 10 hours and then it encountered this area of turbulence as it was crossing the Bay of Bengal. We don't know exactly what happened. Eyewitness accounts say that people were thrown upwards into the storage cabins, that the oxygen masks came down, that debris was flying through the cabin. We've seen photos of it. But the net result is that tragically one person died, a British gentleman of 73, and a large number of other people were injured, some of them seriously.
So there's no reason to think that anyone did anything wrong here. We're just talking about something that can happen in very unusual circumstances on a flight. And I suppose the likelihood is it's the people who happen to be wandering around the plane at that time, going to the loo, going for a walk, who would have been at greatest risk.
Absolutely. Airlines do go to a great deal of trouble to try and divert aircraft around areas in which they think they may encounter turbulence. And sometimes you can see it. Storm cells, for example. Planes will try and divert around those because they know that they will encounter turbulence. But there's a phenomenon called clear air turbulence, which is much more difficult to spot. And pilots often rely on what the previous aircraft going through that area has said about the weather conditions so that they know whether to avoid it or not. So sometimes an aircraft will fly through severe turbulence without being able to avoid it. And in those cases, yes, it's simple bad luck. If you happen to be moving around the aircraft, you're not restrained, you're you're the person who is more likely to be injured, which is why when we travel on board planes, the pilot will tell you, if you're sitting down, please keep your seatbelt loosely fastened, because it can prevent injuries.
We know patterns of weather around the world are changing rapidly. Is there any reason to think that this kind of turbulence will happen more often?
Well, if you listen to the climate scientists, yes, it's possible. There was some research done by the University of Reading quite recently, in fact, which suggested that these kind of episodes are becoming more common and will continue to do so due to changes in the atmosphere brought on probably by climate change. But they are fairly common incidents anyway. Fatalities are rare. But some research done by the National Transportation Safety Board in the United States quite recently found that turbulence was one of the main causes of injuries in flights. Still rare, but they do happen.
Our correspondent, Theo Leggett, with me. It's a plan that's been on the table since 2022. Now the European Union has formally approved the use of windfall profits from frozen Russian central bank assets to arm Ukraine. The news comes as Kyiv continues to urge its allies to ramp up military aid for its troops, who are struggling to stave off an intense Russian offensive in the east. Speaking alongside his German counterpart in Kyiv, Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba called for the EU to go even further.
We all know that the Russian frozen assets are worth around 260 billion euros. While we are grateful for this decision today, the value does not correspond in size to the amount of frozen assets. That is why the third step, which we have been talking about since the beginning of the year, should actually be the confiscation of the assets themselves.
Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard is following the story.
Most of the Russian central bank assets outside Russia are held by the European Union or in European Union countries. Belgium is the big one. So of that 260 billion that you heard Dmytro Kuleba mention, about $220 billion is held within the EU. So the interest they think might earn about $3 billion this year alone. So that's a sizable fee. And basically what the EU is proposing is that a little bit of that interest is held by the institutions that hold the money to cover potential litigation. But most of it is going to be used to help Ukraine arm itself. And then a small amount of it will be used to help its defence industry and also reconstruction. There are some EU countries that are militarily neutral, and they wanted to make sure that that option was available as part of the spend.
Ukraine saying, what about the assets themselves? That money would be useful. Meantime, it's taken the EU quite a long time to get to this point.
It certainly has. Legally, it's extremely complicated. So there's a running debate, Andrew, about how to help Ukraine. The idea being that under international law, Russia would be liable for the damages from its war of aggression. The EU is very clear. It says Russia's full-scale invasion was illegal, unjustifiable and unprovoked. So if that's the case, it's what to do next. This is a first step. There is a wider debate, confiscation of assets. That's what Ukraine wants. There's also a potential third way, which is to use the Russian assets as collateral for a big loan to Ukraine that would be paid off through interest over years. But there is fears that this may actually undermine the international financial system. And Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank, recently warned that if Kyiv's allies are trying to protect the international order, that this may actually undermine it. So this debate is a running one. The G7 is looking into it and hopes to have some sort of update in the weeks and months ahead. There's a summit next month in Italy.
Anything from the Kremlin yet, who presumably won't be happy?
The Kremlin will be incensed by this. I mean, they are very clear. They say that Russian assets are protected by sovereign immunity, that they would try to pursue through the international courts any attempt to seize either the assets themselves or revenues from them. And they've also threatened retaliation. So we wait to see precisely what that retaliation could involve after this move.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard. Both sides have now rested their cases in the sixth week of Donald Trump's criminal trial, without the former president following through on his vow to testify. A jury will now decide if Mr. Trump was involved in covering up a payment to the adult film actress Stormy Daniels, allegedly to silence her. Mr. Trump denies any involvement in this or claims he had sex with her. I spoke to our North America correspondent, Neda Torfik, in New York.
It would have been quite a moment, and one that Donald Trump himself said that he would do. He had said publicly he would testify, but look, many legal analysts had doubted he would, given the fact that he would open himself up to damaging questions by prosecutors. Questions that could hurt not just the legal case potentially, but also would be quite embarrassing potentially for his run for the White House. Questions like if he slept with the adult film star Stormy Daniels, which he has always denied. And so no surprise really that Donald Trump has opted out of testifying. Of course, jurors can't hold that against him because the burden of proof here is on the prosecution. And so we will see the judge remind the jury that they cannot hold it against the former president for not testifying.
So we've heard both sides of the argument. What happens now, Neda?
Well, now the jury is going to come back to court next week, next Tuesday, after the long U.S. holiday weekend, and that is when they will hear closing arguments by both sides. Now, the prosecution has laid out their case to jurors, over 20 witnesses, 200 pieces of evidence. And the defense, on the other hand, has kind of tried to sow doubt in their questions. They ultimately called just two witnesses. So closing arguments from the defense are going to be particularly interesting to listen to, because that's when the defense is going to kind of wrap up their key arguments for the jury and how they see the evidence fitting into that. After that, the judge will instruct the jury on how they should interpret the law to come up with a decision of whether the prosecution has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump did falsify these business records in order to cover up the crime of trying to, you know, break election laws in the United States. And then the jury will get this case and they will deliberate.
Neda Torfik in New York. 3 days of funeral ceremonies have begun in Iran for President Ebrahim Raisi, who died in that helicopter crash on Sunday. Thousands of mourners have joined a procession behind his coffin. But our diplomatic correspondent Caroline Hawley says not everyone in Iran is mourning the loss of their president.
Tightly packed crowds turned out to greet the open-sided truck carrying the body of President Raisi, Iran's foreign minister, and the six others who also died in the crash. Some mourners tried to push themselves forward to touch the coffins. A few broke down in tears. But most Iranians won't mourn the death of a hard-line president, deeply unpopular for his role in crushing dissent. Siavash Adalan of BBC Persian has been monitoring social media to gauge the mood in Iran.
You have three groups of people: those who are opposed to the government, who are very happy that the president is dead. And then you have the social base of the regime, people who are genuinely upset that their president has died and are taking part in different mourning ceremonies. And then you have a whole bunch of people who are just going to use this opportunity, this 5-day public holiday, to go away to their country, to their cottage, and just get away from it all.
The Iranian police are now reported to have filed dozens of cases against people and publications for applauding the crash. Shaken by the sudden death of its president, the regime is attempting to show strength and project a sense of continuity. Prayers were said at the start of a meeting of the powerful Assembly of Experts, the group which appoints a new supreme leader, the ultimate authority in the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the incumbent, is now 85 years old, and Ibrahim Raisi had been seen as a potential successor. A mourning ceremony will be held for him in Tehran tomorrow. Russia and the Taliban are due to send representatives. It's not clear who else will attend.
Acapulco in Mexico was once a big tourist destination, but with a rapid increase in violence, those days are gone. Now, 10 people have been found murdered just days before elections. I've been speaking to our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant.
The most grisly killings were of two women and four men. That was near a market. Now, there's disputes over exact numbers, but at least three others were killed in a separate shooting in a neighbourhood late at night. That may have actually been four deaths, according to local media. And then there was another incident in the tourist part of town, which adds either another one or two more bodies. So the final total in a 24-hour period is either 10 or 12 deaths. It is a shocking day of violence in Acapulco, but ultimately not that uncommon. So it is a very, very dangerous period in the city's history.
And Will, help me with the change there, because Acapulco is associated with glamour, with tourism. It's depicted in movies and songs and all that kind of thing. Why have things changed so much?
Well, I think it's sort of 1950s heyday is now a long, long time ago. Of course, it still has the image of this faded grandeur of a destination for the rich and famous, the association with Elvis and of stars of the 1950s and so on, Johnny Weissmuller. But in truth, Acapulco is situated in Guerrero, one of the most violent states in Mexico, and it is a place where cartel control is absolute in certain neighbourhoods of Acapulco. Other parts of the state are in dispute, so there is violence involved in all of the key industries in which drug cartels are interested, whether or not that's obviously the drugs themselves, the movement of migrants, the trafficking of guns, the movement of money, even into the agricultural sector in that state, and the cartel involvement in the avocado industry, for example, the control of the ports to bring in precursor chemicals for the production of methamphetamine and of fentanyl. So yeah, it is an extremely difficult period in Guerrero and in Acapulco.
And there are elections coming up. From your description, security must be playing a big part in them.
Yeah, security is increasingly one of the key issues in the election. It appeared in a big way in the last presidential debate, with, of course, opponents saying that the current government hasn't done enough under President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and therefore trying to attack his candidate, the candidate from his party, Claudia Sheinbaum, who's the front runner to become Mexico's first woman president. But the debate really circles around the role of the military. President López Obrador has put the entire fight in terms of the leading the security strategy in the hands of the military to a large extent. But he's also said that the concept should be hugs, not bullets, what they call abrazos y no balazos in Spanish.
Will Grant with me from Mexico. And still to come in this podcast. A catchy North Korean tune isn't hitting the right note in South Korea. Sixteen of the world's largest AI firms have agreed on new safety guidelines at the Global Artificial Intelligence Summit, which was opened by the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and his South Korean counterpart in Seoul. They pledged that if their tools don't meet certain safety thresholds, they'll stop developing them or allowing them to be used. Those thresholds will be set in 2025 at the next summit in France. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Today is the first day of this virtual summit, which brings together world leaders and is being hosted by Rishi Sunak. At the heart of the discussion was how to ensure that the rapidly evolving AI technology can be deployed safely in order to maximise its benefits while minimising its risks. A recent report by the Institute for AI Safety, set up 6 months ago, acknowledged that there were currently inadequate methods for understanding exactly how AI tools produce their output, even for their developers. Andrew Strait from the independent research organisation, the Ada Lovelace Institute, said tougher rules were needed.
Voluntary commitments are not sufficient if we're trying to get to the end goal of safe and reliable AI systems that are benefiting people. Voluntary commitments essentially are just a means of firms marking their own homework. They're written in a way where they're often very vague, and it's very easy for firms to say the things they're already doing fit within them. It's essentially no replacement for legally binding and enforceable rules.
Today, the EU AI Act also got its final green light, becoming the world's first legislation governing the booming AI sector. It contains strict rules about how AI tools can operate, with tough penalties for firms which fail to comply.
The authorities in the Indian capital have ordered the immediate closure of schools because of an intense heat wave. On Monday, temperatures in Delhi reached 47 degrees Celsius. The BBC's India business correspondent, Arunoday Mukherjee, sent us this report about conditions in the city.
I'm in Delhi and it's early evening, but still no signs of the day cooling down in the run-up to sunset. It's 45 degrees Celsius right now, sunny and very bright. As soon as you walk out in the open, there is a burning sensation on your skin. When you're trying to breathe in, it feels like you're breathing in hot fumes from an exhaust fan. It's that bad. There is a light wind blowing, which is making matters worse because it literally slaps against your face, reminding you just how hot it is. People are walking around with umbrellas to try and shield themselves from the sun or have had to cover their heads and faces to battle the intense heat. Now, just imagine the plight of all those who have to work in these conditions, like the labourers, construction workers and delivery agents sweating it out. Also imagine India is conducting a massive election in this heat. We have seen voter turnout being impacted, which is why polling authorities have had to extend voting timings sometimes to make it a bit easier for people coming out to vote. And from an economy point of view, well, this heat could affect inflation if crop production and transport is hit. The warning for now, though, is weather officials say this heat will prevail for the next few days in several parts of north, west and central India.
Shalini Sinha from WeGo, a global non-profit that helps informal workers based in Delhi, spoke to my colleague Rahul Tandon about the problems faced by workers there.
The street vendor who sells food in this kind of temperature with no refrigeration, if they are on a cart or in an unshaded place, their food goes bad. Their income goes down because they may have to reduce the number of hours that they are doing their economic work. They may have less consumers on the streets. But if you look at another sector where, say, a domestic worker works in somebody's home, they walk in this heat twice a day and they move from one house to another doing part-time work, which may be cooking, cleaning, etc. Those who do cooking are in front of a hot stove for long hours.
There is increasing evidence that in places like India, it is women often who bear the brunt of the excessive heat when it comes to the workplace. Is that what you hear? Is that what you see?
There are some sectors which are dominated by women, and domestic work is one and home-based work is another. Both of these are invisible in the sense that they are in either your employer's home or in your own home. And women are often combining economic activity with their care activity. So they have to take care of their own household's hydration, family's hydration, well-being, health, if anybody falls ill. So that increases their work burden. At the employer's house, it is not factored in that this kind of impact of heat, for instance, is impacting them. So, you know, no access to toilets, to clean drinking water or shade, or somewhere to sit, or they have to invest in their own umbrellas, in their own, you know, water bottles. All of those are eating into their income. Some of the adaptation strategies which are used by the informal workers, for instance, change in time of work. So during the really hot hours, you don't work. Now, a woman may not have that kind of flexibility to shift her economic work with and care work because, you know, she really suffers from time poverty. Her day is long and divided into care responsibilities and economic activities.
You have very eloquently talked about the challenges that women face. They don't have much protection from the problems that you have outlined. What more can be done to offer them protection?
So the heat stress plans that exist, for instance, they also identify vulnerable groups. But there are short-term measures in terms of awareness, reducing the hours of work. But for a worker who lives hand-to-mouth, reducing the hours of work is never an option. So, you know, we have to think of more broader protection. So we have to think of better housing, climate resilient social protection schemes. We have to think of climate change or heat stress insurance schemes workers can buy. So we have to think also short term and long term.
Shalini Sinha with Rahul Tandon. Now to a rather magnificent creature which rejoices in the Latin name Clanga Clanga. That's the sound of a greater spotted eagle, a rare migratory bird of prey which flies every year to Belarus in Eastern Europe to breed. Belarus is a neighbour of Ukraine, and it seems as if the war there is disrupting the eagle's flight paths and potentially their ability to reproduce. Charlie Russell of the University of East Anglia in the UK has been following 19 of these eagles for a new study published in the journal Current Biology. He spoke to James Menendez.
We started working with greater spotted eagles back in 2017. This is part of a wider project to conserve the wetlands that they live in. to do that, we started fitting GPS trackers to birds so we could understand their movements and what habitats they were using to better inform conservation efforts. We never really expected to be using these GPS tracks and following them through an active conflict zone when we started this work.
When they were migrating and they were getting close to Ukraine, what was happening? What were the battles that were going on, the artillery fire, the shell fire? What was that doing to their flight paths?
As they were kind of returning to the breeding grounds and entering Ukraine, we were seeing on the news as the conflict broke out in Ukraine, kind of what was going on, and following our birds and their GPS tracks to see if there could be any impact on them. And we found that around periods of kind of artillery fire or, you know, intense shelling, our birds deviated from their normal routes, causing them to change direction and fly further than they normally would on migration. And this was kind of on average about 85 kilometers further, but some birds flew as far as 250 additional kilometers compared to previous migrations. Not only were they flying further and expending more energy to do that, they were making fewer stopovers as well. And these are really important periods for them to either shelter from poor weather conditions or to rest and refuel on their long journey. In, you know, some of the most extreme cases, it's almost like running a marathon, but not being able to take any water breaks and having to go an extra 7 or 8 miles at the end of it. They'll be arriving at the breeding grounds a little bit later than normal and a lot more tired from this migration. And their fitness at that time is really important for when they start breeding.
Do you suspect that this is happening to all the migrating greater spotted eagles, that this is a pattern that you would expect to find in most of the population?
Where we work is home to an estimated 150 breeding pairs of greater spotted eagles. We suspect that most of these birds will have migrated through Ukraine, many of them through more intense conflict areas than the birds that we were tracking.
What is it that's special about these birds? I imagine they're pretty impressive, are they?
They're a wonderful bird. They're not the most eagly of eagles. When you think about eagles, you think of these, you know, large and majestic soaring birds. You can quite commonly see them in these open wetland areas, waddling around in puddles, eating things like frogs and lizards, which I just find really quite endearing.
The sounds of the greater spotted eagle there with researcher Charlie Russell. Now, what do you think of this? It's a song from North Korea called Friendly Father, describing the virtues of its leader, Kim Jong-un. It's become a hit on TikTok since its release last month. South Korea is less keen. In fact, media regulators in Seoul say they're banning this Pyongyang propaganda piece. Bernadette Keogh asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, what's going on?
Well, it is catchy, isn't it? And that's really the issue in South Korea. The media regulator has banned access to the song under the National Security Act. They say this song idolizes and glorifies North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. And they say it's a form of psychological warfare because they say the song and the video that goes with it were actually made for an audience outside North Korea. And because the song is in Korean, of course, it's going to be more interesting to those in South Korea than anyone else who doesn't speak Korean. So they say this really is a threat and they're going to take all 29 versions of the song that have gone viral across TikTok and YouTube. They're going to take that down and they really are concerned that this song is more than just something that's quite catchy.
So why are they feeling, why is the South feeling so threatened?
Well, people in South Korea say they think the song is fun to listen to. They like to listen to it in the gym. They say it kind of harks back to a bygone era. But the South Korean authorities are worried because they think the people are becoming a bit complacent about risks. And that's because relations with neighboring North Korea are really dropping to quite a low at the moment. A military pact between the two was thrown out last November. We've seen a huge rise in the number of weapons tests conducted by North Korea. And of course, we have to remember that North Korea now has a really powerful backer in Russia. And Russia is stopping the UN from monitoring North Korea. It's North Korea has gotten new technology help. It's really overhauling its weapon systems with Russia's help. And so South Korea really wants to remind its own population that the threat from North Korea is still very real and is still very present.
our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.